next case, same counsel. Mr. Selwyn, are you ready?
I am, Your Honor.
You know the drill. You're reserving three. So go ahead.
I am. Thank you. May it please the court, Mark Selwyn presenting for Apple and Visa. In its final written decision, the board found mostly for Apple and Visa, determining that all independent claims and seven dependent claims of USR's 826 patent are unpatentable in light of prior art. As to the remaining five dependent claims, the board made two discrete errors. First, for dependent claims 7, 14, 26, and 34, an error based on claim construction and a failure to account for disclosures in the cited Maritzen and Jacobson references showing the disabling limitation met even under the board's improperly narrow construction. And second, for dependent claim 8, an error based on a failure to consider the explanation of Apple's expert for why El Pasita would have understood the Goldman reference to teach the, quote, second plurality of users limitations. And as to substitute claim 50, the board ignored the court's law in failing to recognize that substitute claim 50 is directed to an unpatentable abstract idea, authentication of a user's identity, and does not state an inventive concept because it is implemented through generic computer components operating in wholly conventional ways. This court has seen that kind of patent claim repeatedly before in cases like Prism against T-Mobile, AskGary versus USAA, and most recently this January in Boom against Stripe, and found it patent ineligible each time. There's no reason for this court to deviate from its prior Section 101 rulings in this case. Indeed, the specification itself makes clear that substitute claim 50 uses entirely generic components such as, quote, a general purpose computer system, a commercially available microprocessor, and any commercially available operating system. And looking at the plain language of the claims, the steps are arranged in their natural, conventional order for verifying an account holder's identity before allowing access to the account to enable a transaction. Turning first to the disabling limitation, for dependent claims 7, 14, 26, and 34, the board interpreted the term disable to require, quote, an affirmative act to make the device ineffective or inoperable, and on that basis found that the prior art combinations did not disclose the long and well-known and common-sense idea of disabling a device in response to a failed authentication attempt.
Mr. Selwyn, this is Judge Toronto. Suppose I understood what the board meant by affirmative act was that there has to be a change of state. That is, you can't enable something if it's already enabled. You can't disable something if it's already disabled. You have to change the state. Why isn't the board right then on that understanding?
Because even in that situation, the references disclose that. That is, that in response to a failed authentication attempt, a decision is made either to enable or to disable. So if the comparison fails, then the device continues to be made ineffective and disabled. In other
I guess my understanding, what I was trying to suggest was precisely that is not a change of state. To determine not to change is not to to change the state. So if disable or enable as active verbs require a change of state, that what you just described is not, then it does not meet the limitation.
Oh, but it does, because even in that circumstance, a decision is being made by the device, either to enable it or to disable it in response to an attempt to authenticate.
Okay, I don't think I'm making any progress. I was trying to suggest that a decision is not a change of state. It might be an affirmative act, but it's not a change of state, and that's what I'm trying to distinguish.
Well, disabling and enabling are simply opposite sides of the same coin. When the device is not enabled in response to an authentication attempt, it remains disabled. And the 826 patent doesn't view disablement as a narrow concept. To the contrary, the specification states that the claimed invention can use, quote, any one of a number of known disabled tests, and causing a device to remain locked or not enabled following a failed authentication was certainly one of those known methods. As Apple expert Dr. Shoup explained, a POSITA would recognize that denying access to a device or causing the device to remain locked based on a failed authentication attempt is a method of disabling. But what the board appears to have done is limited disable to a narrow embodiment disclosed in the patent in which the device shuts down and or automatically deletes any portion of data or all the data stored in memory. The description of that embodiment...
This is Judge Wallach. I'd like you to explain Judge Toronto's question using Schrodinger's cat as your example.
I may need a little more context with that, Your Honor.
Or a graduate degree, yeah. Can I, since I know time is short, can I just ask you about this plurality of users element? Is there a dispute here either about what the board meant or about what, on the general subject? When the board said discrete groups, or not discrete, distinct groups of users, did it understand, does everybody understand that those two groups have to be non-overlapping, so that if you had a set of A, B, C, that A, B as one group and B, C as another group would not be what the board had in mind because B is common?
That appears to be right, that the board has read in an additional limitation to Claim 8. But in fact, Claim 8 requires only storing respective biometric information for a second plurality of users. It doesn't require that the different groups, the first plurality and the second plurality, be enrolled or have their information stored in different ways. So subdividing Goldman's multiple users into two groups, a first plurality and a second plurality, would have been obvious. The board's finding that Apple didn't explain how the combination of Jacobson and Goldman would disclose storing information for a first plurality of users and a second plurality of users wasn't supported by substantial evidence because, first, it ignored Dr. Shoup's declaration, in which he explained that, quote, multiple templates for multiple users are stored teaches a device where there are multiple groups of users, and a second plurality of users simply corresponds to a second group of users. And it failed to account for the fact that simply sorting stored biometric information into multiple groups requires no more than the application of ordinary skill. In the petition, Apple argued that although Jacobson doesn't expressly disclose the first device is configured to store biometric information for a second plurality of users, Goldman discloses that limitation. And the board acknowledged that Goldman teaches storing multiple templates for multiple users, but then held that, quote, at best, this discloses storing information for a single group or a plurality of users. That ignores that sorting those plurality of users into a first group of people and a second group of people, just dividing them into two, would be well within a POSITA's ability and Dr. Shoup's testimony that the plain meaning of the phrase biometric information for a second plurality of users merely requires biometric information for a second group of people. And last, Your Honors, to turn to Substitute Claim 50. Substitute Claim 50 is directed to the abstract idea of verifying an account holder's identity before allowing a financial transaction. That's an age-old problem, certainly as old as banking itself.
Can I just ask, this is Judge Toronto, that's an extremely high-level formulation of what the claim is directed to that disregards obvious details in the claim. Do you, we've had a number of cases including the TechSec case, that say when formulating what the step one directed to proposition, you really can't ignore important aspects of the claim. How do we deal with that idea here, that distinction here?
Nothing is being ignored. The claim here and in the next case springs from the basic concept of verifying an account holder's identity before allowing access to their account to enable a transaction. And this court has held that the test for step one of Alice is what the claims are directed to or looking at the focus of the claims. And this court in Erickson instructed that where the bulk of the claim provides an abstract idea and the remaining limitations provide only necessary antecedent and subsequent components, the claim's character as a whole is directed to the abstract idea. That is the case here, that the claim is directed...
This is Judge Stoll. Could you get just a little bit more specific? I feel like you're talking at a kind of a high level. So I hear everything you're saying, and I agree. We're supposed to be looking at the claim and the specification to determine, you know, what is asserted to be the focus of the claimed advance over the prior art. But there's a lot of things in this claim, including a first handheld device, a second handheld device. There's the first biometric information, generating a one-time code, generating a digital signature, encrypting. Could you get into that level of detail and really, you know, talk about the specifics in this claim?
Sure. The claim doesn't involve any new technology for performing the abstract idea. And as this court wrote in the BSG technology case, claims aren't saved from abstraction merely because they recite components more specific than generic computers. Here, the claim offers no new technology for generating, analyzing, storing, retrieving, decrypting, verifying, or authenticating on information. Those are all steps simply to implement the abstract idea, and they all use generic computer components to do so.
You're into your rebuttal time, Mr. Sowen.
And I will conclude here and save the balance of my time for rebuttal.
Okay. Matthews, are you ready to proceed?
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. I'd like to focus right this second on the enable-disable and specifically on the notion that what I believe is most important here, which is that this is Apple's construction of disable that was proffered to the board to make ineffective or inoperative. And in the course of determining whether the prior art disclosed devices that upon a failed authentication are made ineffective or inoperative, the board considered both the construction, the teachings of the 826 patent, and Dr. Jacobson's testimony. And specifically, Dr. Jacobson had explained at Appendix 3554 to 3558, paragraphs 46 to 53, that enable and disable, they're verbs that connote action that changes the state of the device. And he explained that that was consistent with the teachings of the 826 patent, where there were embodiments that showed where a failed user authentication results in shutting down the device or deleting some or all of the data from the device. That's shown at Appendix 100, column 30, lines 7 through 13, in connection with steps 204 and 206 of Figure 22. And Dr. Jacobson also explains why the prior art devices don't disable use, and specifically with respect to Maritzen.
Mr. Matthews.
Yes.
This is Judge Wallach. What state is a device in if it is not enabled?
It is. So we view it as a three. The prior art here and the discussion here and the invention as well as at least a three-state system. The state where it is locked and willing to accept input is called that state one. state two would be where it has accepted input and verified or authenticated the input and unlocked it. That would be state two. And state three would be where there has been attempts to authenticate and the device has determined that some security or protection from fraudulent authentication attempts is necessary because the authentication attempts are failing. And so we're going to disable the device as it's disclosed in the patent, either disable, maybe shut it down or delete some of the valuable data that's on the device because we suspect something awry is going on. And that would be state three. So I would say that the state when it's not unlocked is simply that. It's not unlocked, but willing to accept input. And what Dr. Jacobson had, and with respect to the devices that are disclosed in Maritzen, yes, so I'm sorry, go ahead.
If it's turned off, okay, just, you know, the batteries run out, is it, it could, just clarify for me, it could still be disabled or enabled, right?
Well, if it's off and it remains off, then it would not be enabled.
It would
because so, it's not functioning.
So if it was enabled, okay, and then the battery runs out, it and then somebody recharges the battery, is it still enabled?
It would depend on the device itself. It might have a it might actually be set up so that when the power runs out, it goes back to a locked status where it needs to be unlocked again, right? So that might, you know, there may be a concern that a fraudulent actor has allowed the device to, you know, run out knowing that, that, you know, I'll pick up a device if the battery has run out and then I'll have access to the device. And what the board had relied on was Dr. Jacobson's description with respect to Maritzen. And as I said, there's no dispute about how these devices are disclosed to operate, either in paragraphs 3, 4, and 5 of Jacobson, which was cited for this proposition, for these claims, or in paragraph 67 of Maritzen. And that's that the device is locked and remains locked, open to as many authentication attempts as you would like until you have authenticated yourself properly. And Dr. Jacobson provided his expert view that a skilled artisan would not view remaining locked as disabling the device because it never changes the state of PTD 100 in the case of Maritzen. It doesn't change the state in any way based on a failed authentication attempt. And in fact, if you think about it in terms of making the device ineffective or inoperable, the device is not made ineffective or inoperable pursuant to the construction because the PTD is no more ineffective or inoperable after a failed authentication attempt than it was before the failed authentication attempt. It's at the same, and so under the court's construction, under Apple's construction, it's just not disabled. And I heard this morning that disabling is just the opposite side of the same coin as enabling. So that's a different construction. To argue that disabling then means just not to enable, not only is that not the construction that was provided or adopted, but it creates an issue where if you construe to disable to mean to not enable or to not provide, I'm sorry? To not enable or not provide access to the device, then that effectively reads the phrase or disable out of the claim. If you looked at the claim element in claim 7, for example, it says that the first processor is configured to enable or disable use of the device, of the first handheld device, based on the result of the comparison. If disable just means to not provide access or to not enable, that claim scope would essentially be the same as a claim that read the processor is configured to enable use of a device based on the result of the comparison. But you have to give the phrase or disable meaning in the claim. And the board did that by adopting the construction that you have to take an active step, an affirmative step, to make the device ineffective or inoperable. In fact, while it doesn't come into play because there's no dispute that upon a successful authentication that the device is unlocked, that affirmative act takes place on the enablement side too. So if we were to walk up to a device that was already unlocked and the decision is made that, you know, when the device is picked up, it's not going to be locked without a further authentication, again, there would be no affirmative act that made the device effective or operable. And so under the same reasoning that Dr. Jacobson provided in connection with disable, or that the court adopted in trying to figure out how do I apply the construction to make ineffective or inoperable, in either case, you would need an affirmative act. And in fact, that's, you know, the usage of to make, which is part of the construction, that's the common usage of that term, to cause to happen, to bring about, to change from one form or function to another. And by requiring that the device take an affirmative step to make the device ineffective or inoperative, the board's construction just gives meaning to the verb phrase to make. I do want to point out that with respect to Jacobson, there's some discussion about other portions of Jacobson other than paragraphs 3, 4, and 5 being relied on. The board found that those were the only paragraphs of Jacobson that relied on for this interpretation, for this the claim limitation. The board did consider the disclosure there. They didn't disregard it. What they said was that those paragraphs only generally discuss denying access to a system. That's in Appendix 24, but do not mention specifically enabling or disabling use of a device. With respect to Maritzen's, there was a citation to paragraph 56 that came up on reply to the board, and then also again on appeal. That's at Appendix 1287. That's paragraph 56 of Maritzen. And in considering that disclosure, the board and the court really should take a look at the entire disclosure. The board did consider the entire disclosure within the context, say paragraphs 54 through 57, which describes the operation of the back-end system in Maritzen. This is, if you were to step back for a second, the driver approaches the toll booth, authenticates themselves, successfully authenticates themselves, the biometric key is generated, that then is sent to PTD 100, which then sends a transaction message to the back end to a clearinghouse 130. And now in paragraph 56, we're talking about what happens at the back end. And in that section, it's not describing anything having to do with disabling PTD 100 based on user authentication. What's disclosed there is a possible disablement based on the back end clearinghouse having learned from the financial processor 140 that the transaction is not valid, or perhaps an account not authorized for use. That's at paragraph 55. It's not based on a failed biometric authentication, because this happens after a successful unlocking of the PTD. And what the board found, looking at paragraph 56, is that that disclosure is distinct from unlocking or locking the PTD in response to an attempt to verify the biometric information, and does not suggest that not unlocking PTD 100 is equivalent to disabling PTD 100. That's at Appendix 25. And the board also held that any reliance, this is in a footnote on that same page, footnote 7, any reliance on paragraph 56 of Maritzen to now assert an obviousness of the modification to the PTD would be a new invalidity theory improperly raised on reply. Appellants did not challenge this finding on appeal, and so any new argument of abuse of discretion raised in the reply brief, pages 12 and 13, should be rejected as waived. With respect to substitute claim 50,
can I, this is just Toronto. Can I just ask this question? I know we're about to talk about 101 and at greater length. On the assumption, with which I know you disagree, but on the assumption that in the next case we were to affirm the determination of invalidity for 101 of all four of the exemplary claims, what, if anything, about this substitute claim 50 would be different?
Well, an examination, first of all, well, I'll answer your question because that's a better idea. First of all, looking at Appendix 4829 to 4831, there are a number of limitations that were added to both 45, let me step back again. Substitute Claim 45 is a proposed substitute for Claim 10. So there were limitations that were added to Claim 10 of the 826, the issued claim, that became Substitute Claim 45. Substitute Claim 50 depends on 45. So if you look at the underlying portions, there's a number of additional limitations. Now, it's bad enough. And so with respect to the next appeal, you know, none of those limitations have been considered at all in the 2044 appeal. And in
well, a number of them are the biometric information. A few of them, there's one of the claims in the other in the next case has some encryption. I think maybe, and the one-time code is maybe a variant on the time-varying code. I guess the digital signature is in 50. I don't remember it as being in the others, but so what about what's new or what's different here from those claims might produce a different result on the assumption that you disagree with about invalidity of all of the issued claims?
So to the extent that one would pick and choose elements and say, well, if sort of disembodied from the claim as a whole, then it would certainly include, and I haven't done that analysis, but it would include the digital signature and the other aspects that are different from whatever is in any of the four exemplary claims in the 2044. But what this highlights is that none of these limitations were presented to the board. The only portion of the substitute claims that were presented to the board in connection with an argument that those claims were patent ineligible was the preamble of Claim 36. And we feel strongly that something more than a skeletal presentation needs to be made to the board to preserve an argument for appeal. And that here, Apple had only provided the barest outline of a argument for Section 101 that isn't sufficient to support a reversal of the board's conclusion.
This is Judge Stoll. So are you emphasizing your argument that there was no argument made for the invalidity of Claim 50 and that the board didn't actually find Claim 50 ineligible? Is that what you're emphasizing?
Yes, the board did not find substitute Claim 50 patent ineligible. In fact, it didn't find that any of the substitute claims were patent ineligible based on an analysis on its own of the three independent substitute claims.
I'm sorry, I messed up. I forgot that. Please continue. Go ahead. Go ahead.
I think expired, Ms. Mint.
My time has expired.
You go ahead and wrap up.
Thank you. I was just going to complete that thought, where the board had decided on its own, without any guidance from Apple, to analyze the patent eligibility of the substitute independent claims, had identified a number of the limitations that in the appendix at 37 and 38 that were, in its mind, allowed those claims to not be directed to an abstract idea and, in fact, were directed to an improvement in computer functionality, a topic which I'm sure will be covered at some length in the next appeal. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Selwyn, you have 3 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. 3 points. First on disabling. USR never disputed that Ritson and Jacobson both show enabling the device based on the result of a successful validation, yet they dispute that the same references show the device is disabled as a result of a failed validation. To state it another way, USR acknowledges that Ritson discloses locking and unlocking a device based on a result of a comparison, but that the locking and unlocking is different from disabling or enabling use. That, at best, defies common sense. If the devices are not enabled based on the result of the failed biometric comparison, then necessarily they remain disabled. And Jacobson discloses a system that determines either to generate an authentication code and thereby enable the device, or not to generate an authentication code and thereby disable the device in response to a local authentication. That's what paragraph 59 of Jacobson says. And as Dr. Shoup explains in his declaration, Jacobson, in that paragraph, recognizes that access to the user authentication device 120 can be limited or denied based on the authentication of a user using a PIN, passcode, or biometric information. The second point on Claim 8, Goldman discloses multiple templates for multiple users are stored. That disclosure teaches a first plurality of users and a second plurality of users under the plain meaning of the claim language. The only way the board in USR concludes that Goldman does not disclose the first plurality and the second plurality is by reading in limitations to Claim 8 that the claim does not support. Third issue, turning to substitute Claim 50, and we'll be talking, I'm sure, in a minute in greater detail in the district court appeal about the specific claim limitations. But in short, substitute Claim 50 just has a very long list of generic computer components, the same components that are included in the representative claims. For example, it's directed
and to just to be clear, what by components you include techniques using familiar hardware. You're not just, when you say components, you don't just mean hardware, right?
Correct. I include components and
It's a very slippery term, which has gotten a lot of cases into trouble. You mean both utterly familiar processes on hardware and familiar hardware.
Correct. That is okay. That the components are generic computer components, and the processes that are used on those components are utterly generic. And the specification with respect to Claim 50 emphasizes that all of those components are generic, goes out of its way to emphasize that point. And finally, to answer Your Honor's question, if this court affirms the district court's appeal, its ruling should also apply to substitute Claim 50, as this court recently explained in the Boom case, where a claim is, quote, substantially similar and directed to the same abstract idea as claims that have already been invalidated. It would defy reason to allow a substantial identical claim like Claim 50 here to be the subject of further litigation. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, counsel. The matter will stand.